Come, spellweavers, reavers, rogues, and men-at-arms, and answer the call of adventure. Pick up your sword, your axe, your spellbook, your bow, your rulebook, and your dice, and join the forces of good in their eternal fight against vile monsters, conspiring min-maxers, horny bards, and blood-soaked murder hobos. Discover the treasure trove of role-playing games here on Rollin' Bones. My name is Ryan Howard, and I shall be your guide. Good evening, boneheads, and welcome back to Rollin' Bones with Ryan Howard, where we are making old school young again. I'm your host and king of the boneheads, Ryan Howard, and I am back from North Texas RPG Convention. It was a fun weekend, but it was a long one. So we're going to take it a little bit easy tonight, and I have on a first-timer here on Rollin' Bones. I'll be talking to DM Blackwall. We'll be talking about his game Horde Wars. We'll be talking about historical concepts and how they can inform role-playing games, and we'll probably be talking a little bit about faith as well. Now, before we get into that, just want to remind everyone to like, share, and subscribe if you enjoy the kind of content that we do here on Rollin' Bones. This is the best way to support that and, make sure that other people can see it and other people can jump on and join us here live. And of course, I want to remind everyone to follow me on my various social media. I am at Howard_RyanGregg on Instagram and Twitter. YouTube is Rollin' Bones and Twitch is twitch.tv/RollinBonesRyan. I do have my short form videos on Rumble, and I will be making some short form videos sometime in the next couple weeks, just so that I can have my two for June out in June. So without further ado, one more thing before we bring our guest on tonight. I want to remind everyone the Rollin' Bones Bonehead Emporium is up on TeePublic. You can get your Rollin' Bones and Bonehead t-shirts and your RP Gorillas t-shirts over there. I am actually repping one of my own t-shirts tonight, and I will tell you guys, it's very comfortable. And all throughout North Texas RPG Convention, Levi Combs was repping one of the hoodies. He also said it was very comfortable. So, take that for what it's worth. I think it's a good quality shirt. I'm actually really happy with how this turned out. So I hope you guys will, get one if you feel so inclined. I would love to see someone out there wearing my t-shirt. All right, so without further ado, let's bring on tonight's guest. He is one of my fellow compatriots over on the Basic Experts Gilded server. He is an amateur historian, and he is creating a game called Horde Crawl. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to Rollin' Bones, DM Blackwall.
Hey, good to be here. And it's Horde Wars. I got the cover for you there in the Gilded chat.
Absolutely. Let's go ahead and take a look at that cover.
Miniature version, of course, because Gilded won't support large file sizes.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to go ahead. I'm just downloading it right now so that we can take a look at it. And let me see if that's downloaded. Anyway, thank you so much for coming on Rollin' Bones. You reached out to me a little while ago. It seems like we have a lot in common. We share a lot of common interests. And so I'd love the chance to talk with you about, what you have going on here.
Well, sure. So I went with we're working on a pretty classic medieval fantasy type game. But my co-author and I really felt that there was a lot of things that could be not streamlined exactly, but cleaned up and made more efficient at the game table. We like the game to flow fairly quickly and to have decent tactical depth without having a time sink. And so that's been challenging to design, but I think we've come up with a game that works really well. We do use D12s rather than a D20, so that would be a larger change for some people. But one of the reasons we did that is it allows, other than just liking D12s, is it allows us to embed some game math that we can't do with D20s, because instead of giving you penalties, like if you get cursed or exhausted or whatever, we just have you roll a smaller dice size. So if it was going from a D20 to a D12, that'd be a pretty big jump, but a D12 to a D10, that's not too much. Mm-hmm. And then down to a D8, so on. And that that seems to be a really decent way to account for a few different conditions, being cursed or exhausted or this kind of thing, or just really drunk. Works for that too.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty similar to the way that Dungeon Crawl Classics does it with the dice chain. So I think that's a really kind of neat, intuitive mechanic. And, you know, I really like that. I think it's underutilized in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Another thing we did to help speed up combat is we made all damaging spells attack rolls, which also means that you can score a critical hit. And in our game, a natural 12 is a critical hit. So your odds of critting are quite high, actually.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so if you were to roll a fireball in our game, you'd roll one attack, compare it to defense of all the monsters in the area. And then if you hit, deal full damage. If you miss, deal half, because it's a ball of fire and not a sword strike.
Mm-hmm.
This saves time, because you're comparing one die roll to a bunch of hard numbers instead of having a series of saves with different numbers added to them. And also, of course, because you can crit, you have higher odds of just taking out clumps of opponents rather than having them linger.
Gotcha. And now on screen, you can see the cover here. And I really like this cover. Who did this one for you?
John Torres, the basic expert.
Oh, nice. That's why it looks so good.
Yeah, no, he did a good job on that. He actually did a couple different promotional posters for us. So this with slightly different words, we're going to have the word basic on there, is going to be serving as the cover for our, for the basic version of our game. And then the advanced version, we're planning to use the other piece he did for us, which is more of a red tone with a bunch of armored guys fighting each other with dragons in the background. It also looks pretty cool.
Yeah, it sounds pretty cool. Anyway, we will take a look at some of the other art that you've shared with me here towards the end of the show. But to kind of kick things off here, I want to start the show the way that I start pretty much every show with a new guest. And so let's dig into some of your background here and tell me how you got into role-playing games in the first place.
Well, I was into war games when I was younger. I played a number of those, and that kind of got me interested in role-playing games. And I think I started on second edition D&D.
Okay.
And then I played that a bit. I played third edition more, and then I played a bunch of other games. A lot of D6 system stuff, a bit of D10. I really just a whole slew of them. My co-author, even more, he's probably played like frequently, not just once in a while. He's probably played, I would guess about 50 different systems at this point on a regular basis. But he used to be like a sales rep for Pathfinder at one point. I've also gotten to play some older stuff. I've gotten to play some, what was the predecessor to MERP?
I don't know. I'm all over
anyway,
the place right now.
It's basically Middle Earth role playing, but with the serial numbers filed off. So it wasn't technically, copyright infringement.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. D100 game. Pretty fun stuff. Wildly inefficient if you want to play with those kind of D100 games and you don't have a computer, because it's tables have tables. I've played a lot of them. I've been probably playing and running games now for a quarter century, maybe.
Gotcha. Now what would you say is kind of your fondest RPG memory.
Yeah, Rollmaster. That was it, Shane. Thank you. Couldn't think of it. It was on the tip of my tongue. I've played it in the last 3 months, and I just couldn't think of the name. sorry, your question?
Oh, just, you know, what would you say is your fondest RPG memory? I find that's, you know, our fond memories are what fuels our love for this hobby, which is, you know, why we do what we do. So if you had to pick kind of a fondest RPG memory, what would that be?
I was running a horror game, and I actually got someone to scream. Not his character, the player. That nice. Was pretty fun. But nice. really, in general, it's been just a whole bunch of different heroic moments with friends in which characters are at risk of death. And sometimes they die horribly, and sometimes they're successful in their venture. That tension and danger, I really enjoy.
Gotcha. So, as I mentioned at the top of the show, you are somewhat of a history buff, and that's understating it quite a bit. I watched your stream that you did with Raven Wolfgar.
Oh yeah,
where you guys talked in depth about specifically medieval diseases.
Yeah, I like to read primary sources when I can. So, for example, behind me, I've got a number of things that interest me. So I've in the last year or two, I've read a firsthand account of one of the Crusades. That was pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. Hi, Chris. I've also I've done some comparative analysis between the Epic of Gilgamesh, some tablets that were found at Ebla, and the Old Testament account in Genesis of the War of the Five Kings. And it's fairly obvious, given that you've got three different sources from three different regions, that those people were all alive at the same time, that there was, in fact, a war, because two of the sources describe it. It's really cool to watch how to look at how different historical accounts align. An example of this is and I think as a religious man, you might find this interesting. Mm-hmm. An example of this is that according to this, this king, in Samaria named Gilgamesh, at one point his friend died. And so he decided to solve death. So he went on a journey and found the oldest man he could and asked him about what had happened in the past and how he could fix death. And the old man told him the story of the flood, almost exactly like you find in the Bible, except in his version, the ark was round.
Hmm.
And including details like the releasing of the dove and the raven and this, like, very, very lining up very well. Hmm. And the old man tells him about that and tells him about the tree of life. So Gilgamesh gets the bright idea to go diving in the ocean to look for the tree of life. He finds a branch with some green leaves on it, mm-hmm. and on his way home is tricked out of it by a snake. You may notice some parallels.
Yep.
Just a few. What's interesting isn't the parallels exactly, though. It is that Gilgamesh is alive at the time of at least four of the people mentioned in the Book of Genesis and the War of the Five Kings, and also mentioned at the tablets at Ebla, who were apparently selling weapons to both sides.
Hmm.
You can, because he goes around and meets these guys.
Yeah.
Right? And interacts with them personally. Mm-hmm. Or put another way, you can show that Gilgamesh is claiming to be alive at the same time as Abraham.
Hmm.
Well, if you read the Bible, Shem's still alive, according to the Bible.
Yep.
Time Abraham is. So in that regard, the Epic of Gilgamesh actually aligns with and supports the Bible's claims, mm-hmm. which I thought was pretty cool.
Now, is it possible that Shem is the old man that Gilgamesh talks to?
It is possible, yes.
Gotcha.
So that's some cool stuff. And whether or not you are someone who believes scripture, you can do the same kind of study with lots of other ancient accounts. It's ideal to find two groups who hate each other and a third party. And if they all tell you the same story, it's probably true. And so you can learn a lot about history that way. And so when Raven and I were talking, we were talking about, I had read a firsthand account of a man who was in Constantinople and a government official when the Black Plague hit. And not only, or not the Black Plague, I should say, the Justinian Plague when it hit. And not only that, he had been in charge, been in a government position for the year previous, and they knew it was coming, watching it creep across the empire. And unlike most of his contemporaries, he survived this event. And so we have an excellent firsthand account. It's not the only one, but it is, I believe, one of the only ones of a high-ranking official for that particular plague. Which is pretty cool. And it was, mm-hmm. it was a tragic story, of course, you know, in the city, probably 90% or more die off. And to the point where they were filling the guard towers with bodies like they were grain silos because they couldn't burn or bury them fast enough. Like, that's a pretty tragic story.
Mm-hmm.
But the people who survived preserved it, which is to say they thought it was true.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's really interesting. And the way people think about history and the way people talk about history. I was watching a video. Are you very familiar with Metatron on YouTube?
I am.
I was watching one of his videos today. He recently did a video about basically historical revisionism as, you know, like a just kind of a broad topic. And I don't know. It's interesting when people say things like all history is revisionism because we don't know for sure exactly what happened. But then again, you do have these stories that seem to survive for long periods of time. You know, they seem to be perpetuated for some reason or another. And so, you know, while we can't know for sure unless we, you know, are there and see it with our own eyes, the fact that someone decided that this version of events was worth preserving for some reason should tell us that it's significant, if not true.
Right. And for truth, in history, one of the ways that you can have a pretty good chance of it being correct is, like I said, if someone claims it, their enemies agree with them, and then you find a third party who says the same thing.
Yeah.
There's a pretty good chance, and that's really hard to find all three of those at once for any given event. But if you can, there's a really good chance that's exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Also, for some of it, we do know how they got preserved and why. So in the case of the tablets at Ebla, these were trade records they were keeping. And when their city was destroyed, it was destroyed with fire. And well, turns out clay tablets do okay in a fire. They actually get hardened.
Yeah.
And so it was preserved because their city got sacked and burned to the ground. And the building these tablets were in actually collapsed on top of them. And so we have over 100,000 intact tablets today. It wasn't that they tried to preserve them exactly. It was a happy accident.
Yeah. Yeah. And things like that. I mean, you know, people will hold on to trade records. Even, you know, kind of, you know, apocalyptic situations aside, you hold on to trade records because you need those.
Yeah.
I mean, those kinds of things surviving, one, they're detailed by nature because they have to be, and two, they're well preserved. They're kept up to date. Otherwise, you know, if they're not, then whoever was doing the trading is not a very good businessman.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
Having a record like that is very historically significant.
Yeah. One of the cooler trade records is actually also from Sumeria. We have 7 different letters written on clay tablets from various members of an extended family to one another, to the point where we know the names of most of the family. But what's silly is what they're writing about.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about tax evasion. Seriously, like they're discussing how to evade getting searched and having to pay certain taxes as they trade from city to city. they also have like personal notes, like, you know, how's your uncle or that kind of thing, or greet your sister for me or this sort of stuff. But mostly it's they're writing to each other about tax evasion, and we have seven of their letters.
Nice. I mean, that's based, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. It also kind of makes you wonder how many there were originally.
Yeah. Now, relating this specifically back to role-playing games, I'm someone who likes a bit of historical accuracy in role-playing. However, there is a not insignificant amount of people who, whenever you bring up the words historical accuracy or historically accurate, they immediately groan and go, oh, it's got elves and dragons in it. Why does it have to be historically accurate? So I will pose that question to you in kind of a more fair way. Do you think that historical accuracy improves role-playing games? And if so, in what way?
Oh, mostly yes. There are exceptions, of course. But in general, if you want to be, say, playing a knight who slays dragons, there are certain things that you're, in effect, agreeing to have to be true. One, that there are knights. Two, that there are dragons threatening people in some way. And thirdly, that there is the necessary society to support both of these things.
Mm-hmm.
The moment you're like, I want to play this kind of RPG, you just kind of have to make those assumptions. The same would be true if you wanted to play a sci-fi game. You have to assume, if it's one oriented around space travel and exploration, that you have found some way to travel to other stars. It's kind of baked into the genre. But also, I think that especially for history or for even for modern or for sci-fi gaming, including real history makes it more believable. I'll give you an example. I had a group of atheists and agnostics that I ran 5th edition D&D for, but we had a custom setting. And one of the things I did, because I thought it would be kind of cool, is I incorporated the real Canaanite religion, including their various religious practices from the period of the Old Testament, especially the earlier period. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, every single one of those players decided that genocide was the answer. They decided to kill everyone involved in that religion,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was hilarious. I told them what they did. I was like, you guys realize that you are just deciding on your own to do what God told the Jews to do, right? Told the Hebrews to do. They cracked up. They thought it was great.
Congratulations. You've recreated the book of Joshua.
Yeah. Yeah, they did on their own without ever having read it,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was pretty cool. But they bought it. They bought it as a believable thing because it was based very specifically on real history. And I'll do the same thing with a little bit of disguising in general. But a lot of the guys who have been playtesting Horde Wars with me, especially online, have commented about how a lot of the plot lines they can see are borrowed from history as they kind of go along.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the reasons they've been actually enjoying it, is because a lot of the history or a lot of even the like setting information is borrowed from real history, which makes it believable. Nice, mm-hmm. Chris. And so, for example, we have a holiday where the specific practices are real world practices from Denmark.
Mm-hmm.
We don't tell you that, but because they are actually borrowed from a real society, you read it and you're like, oh yeah, people would do that. People would do these weird rituals. And they would, because they do in real life still, although less than they did in the past. I think historical accuracy is good. Now, there is a limit, of course. One is you're playing in a certain genre when you're playing in a fantasy role-playing games. So you gotta ignore history in that regard. But also, you could add minor things. For example, I added potatoes into my medieval setting because I like potatoes.
Oh, yeah.
Is that historically accurate? Goodness, no. But it's probably not going to like destroy the society or really massively reshape any kind of setting assumptions. Mm-hmm. Unlike, say, if I gave them machine guns.
Right. Yeah, it's something that I've been mulling over. I've been thinking about like ways that I love to cook. And so I've been thinking about ways that I could incorporate like cooking into role playing and make content around that. And one of the things I was thinking about was so often the meal you get at a tavern in D&D is some form of meat and potatoes. And in medieval Europe, there were no potatoes because potatoes were native to North and South America.
Right.
And weren't brought over until the Age of Exploration. But then I got to thinking, but there's no South America. So
yeah,
potatoes could come from somewhere.
Right. And hilariously, by the way, what finally got potatoes to take off as a food was essentially Frederick the Great threatening his own farmers, going, you will plant this crop because it has higher yield per acre or bad things will happen to you. Mm-hmm. And the reason the farmers didn't want to do it is at the time the potato was viewed as an aphrodisiac of all things.
Yep.
And so they didn't want the reputation associated with growing it.
It'd be like being a drug dealer.
Yeah, yeah. Or the seller of only green M&Ms.
Yep. Now, Derek Clay, a.k.a. the Dukester here in chat, brings up one of my favorite uses of historical accuracy. And this is because I'm a dork. But when it comes to how weapons are used in the context in which like a certain weapon is used, that's a big thing in my game. I don't like it when players try to use a polearm in a tight corridor.
I agree. Well, mostly. You could use it in a tight corridor that's long.
Yeah, you could use it as a thrusting weapon.
But... Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. I think, actually, I'm gonna quick grab a chunk of the rules for you to look at. I think you actually will really enjoy how our weapons behave baseline, and this is without any character abilities. But if that's a thing that you find important, one thing that we did, and you'll need a little table to understand what the words mean, so I'm going to show you that first. So let's see here, put this in gilded. So basically, we played around with crit triggers is the short version. Or put another way, we gave the weapons certain base behaviors that would happen when they score a critical hit or under other circumstances. So I'm going to just show you the top of the melee weapons table so you can get a sense of it. We probably got, I don't know, 50 or 60 weapons or so. So this isn't anywhere near all of them, but it'll give you an idea. There you go.
And give me just one second to get this pulled up so that everyone can see it.
Yep.
First, I will show the table that you sent over. So
yep.
Let's navigate back over here. There we go. So yep. Melee and ranged weapon properties.
Yeah. So assassination, for example, is something that we put on... certain exotic weapons, also on daggers, because in real life, you want to win a knife fight fast. And ideally by ambushing your opponent.
Yeah.
So you effectively, in game terms, get a surprise round and then ideally win initiative and nail him again. Right? So we set up knives to incentivize fighting as though they're knives.
Yep.
Okay. So you get extra damage during that first round. Brace... This is the primary effect of some of our pole arms. And the reason for this is because it's what you want to do to a mounted combatant or to his mount. You want to knock them down so you can take them out, surround them and kill them. A defending weapon is pretty basic. Shields have this, but also like a dueling dagger.
Yep.
Right. A heavy weapon, something like an axe, would have this effect. Where if you manage to land a crit, it's going to hit hard because it rolls an extra die, and that also gets doubled. Impact, we put that on a lot of the swords, so you have a higher odds of critting in general. Offhand, about 17% of the time you'll crit. Inhibiting, something like a whip. Wrap, you know, so if you crit, you basically wrap their legs and they can't move. Bolas, yep. Same deal. And so on.
Yeah.
Anyway, this was one of the mechanisms we used to try to help these weapons behave the way they did historically.
Yep, and as you can see here, like Dan Blackwall was mentioning, several of these do have those properties. I mean, down here you see dagger and punching dagger for assassination. Warhammer is heavy and penetrating. And this is one of the things that I actually really like about this, specifically with the Warhammer in particular, with the penetrating property. And the mace has it as well. There's not a lot in many role-playing games to account for the fact that when you are up against an armored opponent, you want a blunt weapon. Yeah. I always have my like paladins and stuff like that carry a hammer as well as a sword, because I, in my head, know that and know that, you know, an armored knight in real life would carry both of these things in case he came up against another armored opponent. But there's not anything that really accounts for that in the rules. So I'm glad that you guys have added something here to make that matter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And our armor actually typically protects from, lets you take less damage from physical attacks, like slashing or blunt damage or this kind of thing. Where the Warhammer, if you crit, it just completely ignores the effects of their armor. Right? Same for the poleaxe, the mace, and the Morningstar. Because these weapons actually were used by knights against each other. Knights almost never deliberately attacked each other with swords unless they were wearing gambesons.
Right.
Because they aren't good weapons against a fully armored opponent in plate. You can do it. It's just not what you'd pick if you had another choice.
Right. Yeah. And that's also why every knight carried a round dagger, because you could get up under a helmet with that.
Exactly. So we've played around with this, but like I said, we've got a whole probably 50 or 60 of these. And then we've got separate properties for like artifact or magic weapons that get added on as well. Yeah. But that hopefully gives you some idea of just of kind of our design approach.
Now I do have to ask, in seeing this, are you at all influenced by Rule Cyclopedia with some of these?
Oh yes, in the sense that we're trying to sell you now. The basic game is just levels 1 through 4. But advanced, which we're hoping to have out about a year after, the basic we're hoping to have up initially on Big Geek Emporium and then maybe some other sites as a PDF in September. Hoping to do our advanced game in about a year later in print and as a PDF. But our goal is to sell you a whole game. Like, it's levels 1 through 4 for basic, and then it will be levels 1 through 12 for advanced. But it's all the stuff you need to play. It's not like half of a game or buy all our supplements. We want the whole game in a single volume, either just the low-level play stuff all together or everything all together. In that regard, we're very much inspired by Rule Cyclopedia, because we don't want you to have to waste your money.
Yeah, and unfortunately... when it comes to buying into a new RPG, a lot of the, you know, things that stop people is, you know, okay, how many books am I going to have to buy here? Because usually there's Player's Handbook, then a Monster Manual, and then a GM's Handbook.
Yeah.
And so, you know, being able to combine most of those into one book is definitely a way to sell the game to people.
Well, depending on the metrics you use, I would say that we're actually able to include more content in less pages. Or put another way, because of how we have you build your character for our game system, we're putting in, ignoring that you can have different features and that you can play a different species. I believe we have over 400 different, essentially character classes that you can play. Mm-hmm. But the way we do that is they're basically built as half careers or as half classes, and you pick two.
Okay.
And so you can mix and match them and create various combinations to suit your play style or some particular historical or mythological figure that you want to mimic.
Gotcha.
But we've also got in the advanced version, I think we've got like 250, 300 monsters, something like that, stat blocks for you to fight, which is getting really close to a full monster manual just inside the one book.
Yep.
But then we're also including setting material. We're also including, let's see, 100 in the basic game, 80 unique artifacts, and then like I think it's over 10,000 generatable artifact weapons. And then for the advanced game, same deal with the artifact weapons, but you get an extra 40 or 50 unique artifacts. Mm-hmm. And in addition, we've got just goofy amounts of procedurally generated other treasure items. That took us some time to design, but you could use that in any game, really. You could just take those tables, switch the money to whatever currency your game uses, and just read the descriptions, and you could use them. That's something that always bugged me in earlier versions of D&D, especially, and a lot of the kind of retro clones. They just did not have much interesting treasure other than a few mm-hmm. magic items.
Yeah,
but essentially, we're able to put in with a lot of work in terms of design space into about a 360-page book in print for the advanced version when we come out with that. The same amount of material or more as 5th edition D&D, for example, has done in its three core books.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the goal from the start, not for 5th edition specifically, but that you be able to get equal or more content in one book. So that's.
Yeah, absolutely. And honestly, like when you look at the way, and I try to avoid the WotC bashing as much as I can, because I just don't even want to think about them. But when you look at the way that they do their books, there is so much wasted space and so much just kind of non-content in those books.
Yeah.
That like you can look at them and be like, all right, yeah, you could switch things around and you could probably consolidate a few of these books, and you definitely have, you know, kind of more effective and fewer books. Now, I know that goes against kind of their selling strategy, but again, well, like
mine's real simple.
Yeah.
Nate and I are working on three different role-playing games right now that have some interconnected core concepts. So mm-hmm. basically, if you buy Horde Wars Basic, you're going to like Horde Wars Advanced if you enjoy that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you like that and are interested in the genre of the other games we're working on, which is a dark future superhero game and then a sci-fi game, including full space combat rules, if you like our one game, you'll like the others if you like the genre. Yeah. If you don't like the one game, you won't. So our selling point isn't so much buy a bunch of books to play our one game. It's we're going to make you complete games, and we're putting in a lot of time to develop and test them. So Horde Wars itself has been in development for about 5 years, and we've got what? Probably close to 2,000 hours of play testing done now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a system where we've actually tried out almost all of the things that you can do in various ways repeatedly with different players to see what would happen. And then when we find problems, we have fixed them.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I've gotten way too many RPGs that I've gotten either supplements for, especially, or sometimes core books where clearly no one played it.
Yeah. Yep.
And there are problems.
Mm-hmm.
One of the more ridiculous ones was a supplemental core book to third edition D&D. It was like Player's Handbook 2 or something.
Mm-hmm.
That had a built-in way by combining two of the abilities in that book to never die of hit point loss. And you could get there by character level 3.
Oh God.
Which is not a good design.
Nope. This is why people didn't like third edition.
But clearly no one had ever actually play tested that thoroughly, or they would have caught it.
Mm-hmm.
They'd have been like, oh, we shouldn't, at the very least, we shouldn't put these things in the same book.
Yep.
Or maybe we shouldn't design it this way at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and maybe this is too daunting to suggest to, you know, aspiring publishers, even though I myself am an, you know, aspiring publisher. But in the world of role-playing games, you are selling to an audience of people who are going to sit down with your book, they're going to completely take it apart, and they're going to see what combinations of things they can do to either mess with their players or mess with their GMs. That's the mindset that a lot of people approach reading rule sets with. And as, you know, game creators and publishers, we have to take this into account.
Yeah, one of the best bits of feedback I got on the superhero game that we're also developing from one of the playtesters was he felt like he couldn't break the speedster. I'm like, good. Good. Yeah. That's by design. I'm like, do you feel like you can go fast and do cool things? Yeah. All right. Good. That was the goal.
Yeah. Speedsters are broken everywhere else. So, you know, we're going to keep them reined in here.
They are. It is a challenge to design it that way. But, mm-hmm. And like I said, it takes a lot of play testing. So like our sci-fi game, we've probably got 600, 1,000 hours, something like that in. And then the superhero one, we've probably got, I don't know, 300 to 500 hours of playtesting in.
Gotcha.
Rex Teal, he was both disappointed and also giving me a compliment.
Yep, I know the type. Sorry, go ahead.
But it's doing exactly what you described. You know, mm-hmm. I try to find at least a few playtesters like that every round of playtesting to go, okay, try to do something dumb. Let's see if you can break this.
Yep. Absolutely. Now, kind of going off in a different direction entirely, one thing that we have in common that we've discussed, ahead of the show is, you know, both of us are Christian men.
Yeah.
And I have found, one, there is a not insignificant number of Christian role players. I had actually multiple conversations this past weekend at North Texas with a few of them. And, you know, it seems like every day on, you know, Gilded, a couple of us find out about each other, just, you know.
Oh, yeah.
The other day I was talking to clerics who wear ring mail, and we figured out that we have that in common. And then you and I figured out that we have that in common. And, you know, just on and on down the line, we're all kind of, you know, running into each other and finding each other. And this is something that I find somewhat ironic, because I very much grew up in a household where my parents were very nervous about the idea of me playing games like Dungeons and Dragons. So I do have to ask, was that the case in your household as well?
Oh yeah. My parents banned it pretty hard. and then it didn't work. And interestingly, they've completely reversed their position on it now.
Mm-hmm.
But that's because they've spent more time learning about the subject rather than listening to what I would describe as television fear-mongering.
Yes. Yeah, and I do think a lot of it is left over from, you know, the 80s satanic panic. I know, you know, take a shot when your RPG podcast mentions satanic panic, but it really, I can't state enough how much of an impact that continues to have on people, especially people like myself who grow up as Southern evangelicals. So, I mean, whenever people think that, like, you know, the satanic panic is, you know, come and gone, some people are still thinking of D&D in those terms.
Well, I would say that there is, I'll pick on another game for a minute. There is some real evidence that you probably shouldn't let people who have a thin grasp on reality play LARP games like Vampire the Masquerade. There's some actual evidence that that's a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
Because there were some murders associated with that.
Yes.
But that being said, that is not normal. One, most role-playing games aren't played that way. And two, even the ones that are normally don't have that issue. It's why it did make the news. It's why it was a big deal.
Yep.
And so I think that as I've gotten older, I've been trying to be careful to not have anyone play in groups that I'm in the long term who seems to be struggling with keeping the difference between reality and fiction separate.
Yeah.
But other than that, I think it's a largely unfounded fear.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's one of those things, and I've seen a couple different explanations for why it took off the way it did. But it really is one of those things where a couple edge cases were blown out of proportion, or essentially in an effort to deflect blame from themselves or from something else, people decided to reach for D&D or comic books or heavy metal or, you know, whatever it was that they wanted to throw in front of themselves as, you know, defense for their own shortcomings. But, you know, I bring that up to say, I've been thinking a lot about this lately, why there are so many of us religious guys, Christians specifically, who are really into this hobby. And one of the reasons that I've kind of, you know, come to the conclusion of is, as Christians, we believe that there is good and there is evil, there's right and there's wrong, and that we ought to be seeking the good and seeking to eliminate the wrong. And there's no more kind of direct parallel to that than being a hero fighting evil in a game like D&D or Castles and Crusades or, you know, whatever, you know, fantasy RPGs.
Sure, I got one of their rule books behind me too. But no, I agree. But importantly, this also applies for most agnostics, most atheists, most people in other religions of various sorts. Most of them, to some level, have an understanding of right and wrong, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It is very rare that you'll meet an actual sociopath or psychopath. And even them, they usually know the difference. They just don't feel it. But if you want to have an exciting game, a way to engage your players, one of the best ways to do it is to give them real moral choices. Mm-hmm. Even if they choose the wrong path, even if they decide to do an evil thing or find some goofy compromise they came up with, it will make a more memorable story because it plays with the fact that the players do know the right thing to do. It'll make it stick in their head more. The same is true, by the way, to a lesser degree, with timers in a game.
Mm-hmm.
For example, because you're actually a bunch of real people sitting around a table, virtual or in person, when you enter a room, hear the clatter of dice, your DM rolls a timer. You, the player, have now got increased tension. You know something is about to happen.
Yep.
And you don't know what it is, even though your character has no idea. This plays with the fact of the way that of how the game is played and who is playing it. And so I think I think that using components like that, using components like a timer that the players are aware of, but the characters may or may not be, depending on its nature, and using real moral choices that the players are aware of what they should do, even if their characters are a bunch of vagabonds, that will make more interesting stories for you to remember years later.
Mm-hmm.
And it also just drives player engagement. Players will actively sit up and be more interested.
Yep. I've also found that there are a couple of concepts in role-playing games that I've seen people struggle with that I, you know, as a Christian, don't necessarily find any issue with. The biggest one that I'm talking about is the idea of paladins being restricted in their alignment and the idea of what a paladin is. A lot of people that I've gamed with who aren't religious generally look at a paladin and go, you know, I don't want to be a goody two shoes. I don't want to, you know, be Mr. Always has to do the right thing. But I look at a paladin as the ultimate example of self-sacrifice in the name of a higher good. And this is something aspirational to me. So do you see any concepts like that where in a lot of ways it seems like religion helps you kind of come to a deeper understanding of what something is or what something is supposed to represent in the game?
Oh, well, let me quick show you our version, a piece of our version of the paladin. So I'm gonna share that with you. But to answer your question, if you're gonna play in a medieval European style fantasy, you need to have something like Catholicism. It was a major pillar of society at the time. You need to have some kind of monotheistic and fairly dominant religion in at least a significant portion of the world, because it's part of the society.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to, generally speaking, be in favor of good things, law, order, etc. Otherwise, the society would fall apart if the entire institution is just corrupt and, I don't know, murderous.
Yeah.
So, and so that's a consequence of just kind of this particular genre. So I think that it's useful in that regard. And I do think that you can definitely use religion to drive plot, like I did with my group of agnostic and atheist friends, with a vile religion that they correctly identified as something that should be wiped out. Mm-hmm. I think there's some room for that. But have a look at the Crusader. What do you think of the description?
I'm going to pop this up here so that everyone can see it. Let me make sure. I've got the right one. There we go. All right. So, Crusader. A Crusader is a warrior who has dedicated himself to fight in honor of the Creator. Most of the time, the Crusader fight to reclaim or protect relics and holy sites. Examples of Crusaders from history include Richard the Lionheart and Godfrey of Bouillon. I love it. I love it.
And then read what he can do.
So skills, combat, faith, plus one skill of your choice. Let's see. Paladin, absorption. Whenever you wear a heavy armor, your armor absorbs the first damage that you would take from an attack each round. In addition, you can wear heavy armor without a speed penalty. Cleave. Whenever you make a weapon attack, you may use cleave to apply that attack against additional targets. And Dawnblade, whenever you make a melee or ranged weapon attack, you may deal solar damage instead of the normal damage type.
So this guy can basically smite, cleave through enemies, and when he wears heavy armor, it is uniquely protective. It is far more effective when he wears it than some other guy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, and you mentioned something earlier, when you were talking about any kind of medieval setting needing something that roughly approximates Catholicism, this is why I don't like the idea of evil clerics or evil paladins. I mentioned this when I did my thread on the cleric. Someone mentioned, well, you know, if you have an evil cleric, they might have to take a vow that's the opposite of, you know, poverty and chastity. And I went, okay, yes, but I don't think there should be evil clerics because that's not how evil functions.
Well, you would have like cultists and the like.
Yeah.
You would have people who worship demons or who are members of other other religions that are perhaps where they're worshiping false gods of various kinds who may give them various abilities, but they shouldn't be the same abilities. That would be very odd.
Right.
Because let's pretend that if you had 500 different deities in your world and one of them claims to be the only deity and supremely powerful, and yet five other ones can exactly mimic his abilities, that would be proving him wrong. That would obviously be an untruth. And so if you're going to have something like a monotheistic religion that's taken seriously in the game world, at the very least, it has to have somewhat unique abilities or powers associated with it, because otherwise no one in the game world would believe it. Because you're in a world where the other deities' followers have powers of various sorts, or where demon worshippers have powers of various sorts, and that is evidence of their existence.
Mm-hmm.
And their power. So, like, you know, so we've got like witches and warlocks and this kind of thing, but they're not playable. They're opponents.
Right.
We have necromancers, again, opponents. Liches. We have cultists of various sorts. We've even got some Cthulhu-style monsters. I saw Chris was writing about that earlier. We've got some deep ones in our advanced version.
Mm-hmm.
But that's because evil really should be evil and powerful, or it's otherwise, why are you having to fight it? When you could just, I don't know, tell it to go away and watch it collapse. No, evil should be powerful and dangerous to the player characters,
mm-hmm.
so that they can actually be heroes.
Yeah. Yeah, and the way that I kind of feel that it should be split is good deities that, you know, function in that kind of the function essentially in the place of Catholicism for your you know, medieval world, or medieval approximate world. The power granted to a cleric or a paladin is given so that they may serve, and their ethics are deontological. So it's all based around service and sacrifice and duty in the name of, you know, what your God sees as good. Evil, on the other hand, I don't feel like is deontological just by its very nature. I feel like an evil religion or evil religious structure would have to be essentially consequentialist.
Well, you can, of course, have an evil religion. It would just be very silly to devote it to something that is only evil all the time, because there would be no use in following it. It would betray and murder you and such. It would have to give you some kind of benefit for you to want to follow it. But evil in the sense of wanting goals that are opposed to good and right things? Oh, yes. Of course you could have such religions. I just sent you, you're welcome to share or just have a glance. I sent you a few sample religions from our basic game. Now, the advanced will have a few more in there. But just to give you a sense of, there's a little bit of setting info, but to give you a sense of the kind of religions we're portraying.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, this all looks pretty cool as far as, especially in the context of recreating what medieval religions would look like, because you have the Church of the Creator, which is your kind of, you know, Catholic Church stand-in. Cult of the Dark One.
And you'll notice we actually call that out.
Yes.
In the description.
And then the, you know, the Cult of the Dark One, these are the kind of, you know, blood magic ritual, sell your soul to extraplanar beings kind of religions. You've got orc religions, which are, you know, tribal polytheistic religions.
Yeah.
Same thing with kind of the Eastron religion. A little bit of Greekness in that one as well. A dragon religion.
And the Drakkarans are just straight up human sacrifice with dragon worshippers.
Yes. But yeah, I mean, as far as just, you know, a spread of essential religions or, you know, sample religions that you should have in a medieval type world, I do feel like that's a pretty good list there.
Thanks.
And definitely. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, that's what we intend. That's what we're going to have in the basic version. Advanced will have a few more.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll notice we don't have the Deep Ones cult in there.
Yeah.
Well, that's because the Deep Ones aren't included in basic. They're probably a little too dangerous for low level characters.
Yeah. Yeah. Fourth level, you run up on a Shoggoth. You better have an exit strategy. But no, as we're kind of running up against our time here tonight, I do want to, you know, show some of this other art that you you sent me here. We've got some monsters here to show people. So,
sure.
First up, we've got this this looks like an electric squid of sorts.
Yeah, so this is one of our aberration type creatures, and what these things do is they live in caverns, typically in holes in the ceiling. And they wait for creatures to pass underneath, where they zap them with their tentacles, paralyzing them, and drag them screaming up into the darkness to eat them. They usually attack in groups. They're not usually solo monsters. There's usually half a dozen or so that will go after one guy.
There's nothing quite like a good ceiling monster. Always makes dungeons very dangerous. And looks like we have ourselves a goblin here.
Yeah, that's a goblin taskmaster. So one of the cool things he can do is use one of his actions or maneuvers to order other goblins to move during his turn. So he can basically force them to rearrange themselves on the battlefield.
Gotcha. And, I mean, with the game being called... you know, with Horde it having the title that it has of Horde Wars, this is focused around large-scale combat, is it not?
Yeah, yeah. Being able to fight. Our very first test game, it was a group of five players against 30 or 40 goblins
mm-hmm.
in a single combat. And our intent is very much that you be able to do that kind of heroic stuff while also being at real risk of being slaughtered.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Because, and this is kind of the struggle when it comes to mass combat in role-playing games. You want players to have that experience of, you know, we fought just this giant mass of enemies and we cut down, you know, multiple on, you know, with each slice of our sword, we were, you know, decapitating four orcs. But at the same time, you don't want them to be overpowered. Otherwise, the challenge of you're being attacked by multiple things starts to fall by the wayside.
Right. So finding ways to build encounters and monsters in particular so that they can fight and punch up if necessary has been very interesting. And the playtesting has really helped. So one of the other images you have is of a dread skeleton.
Mm-hmm.
The dread skeleton is, unlike other skeletons, it has kind of an aura around it that drains the life out of you slowly, which means a dread skeleton never has to actually hit you to harm you. He just has to be close to you. And you'll slowly lose hit points
mm-hmm.
for each one next to you. So if you were fighting normal skeletons and like they're hitting you with their swords or maces or spears or bows or whatever, and you're cutting through those easily, well, we offer the dread skeleton to your game master to give you something a little bit scarier.
Yeah.
And it scales well. I had a seventh level party almost die, all of them, to dread skeletons because mm-hmm. they did not correctly identify how dangerous the threat was until they were surrounded.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's, I like anything that makes kind of your garden variety skeleton just a little bit scarier, because the idea, you know, skeletons are mooks.
Yeah.
But the idea of a whole bunch of skeletons animating and attacking you is terrifying.
Yeah.
So finding new ways to amplify that terror, even as you level past the point where just your standard skeleton is much of a threat to you, I think that's very valuable and worthwhile. And so, you know, I think this is a pretty cool idea.
Thanks. Also, I should note that other than when you get to a new capstone, you only gain 2 hit points a level in our game.
Gotcha.
So even low level monsters do remain technically threatening at high level. Just frequently, you have other ways to deal with them other than just getting hit a bunch.
Hmm. And then last but not least, we have this interesting monster here.
That is a false door. And so essentially we have a creature that its ecology, its means of survival and living are that it can create an illusion of a perfectly normal door, which just hides its mouth. And then if you go open that door, it'll eat you.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you go near it, it can try to like actually attack and pull you in. I had a group of players fall for this at an outhouse. So, and I gave them a clue. So there was this outhouse that's like all dilapidated, you know, rotted wood. And there's a door next to it on the ground, also rotted wood. And there's a brand new shiny door in the door to the outhouse in the entranceway. One of the players thought he'd go open it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got eaten.
Beware the fancy door.
Yeah, so they managed to save him before he got finished getting digested, which is probably best. I also did this at Cabin Con with the guys from Big Geek Emporium.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in this dragon cave, and it was all like natural stuff, like as far as threats went. Like there were some poisonous mushrooms or some like vines that might grab you and this kind of thing, like natural creatures though, and a natural cavern that this dragon was living in that they were exploring. And then there was this random door. And the oldest and most experienced player who had never played against that monster in our game, because he'd only ever played that weekend, went, "Stay away from the door," and he kept going. Two of them did not keep going. He looks back. They've both been eaten. And then it fell on him and the remaining two players to rescue those two, or try to at least.
Yep.
But yeah, no, it's a fun monster. I think our artist did a really good job there. This is Simeon Cochran.
Nice. Yeah, this is pretty cool looking. It's a good take on kind of a familiar concept. Everyone's familiar with the mimic, but I feel like this kind of does that in a really interesting way, because, yeah, I mean, like an adventurer will want to open the chest or something like that, but there's nothing quite so intriguing to adventurers as random doors, especially doors that don't maybe look like they belong.
Yeah, yeah. Well, actually, that one's still, Rex Teal. That one is just ate someone, so he's still putting his illusion back. You'll see the blood seeping from under the door.
Yeah.
We wanted to have some fun with stuff in the genre, and also have a few unique monsters. Like we have one called a siren snail that has a kind of a combination of the effects of a siren, like from Greek mythology, and something akin to a flail snail from D&D. So we made this, and I had no idea what it would look like until our artist sent me an image. I just wrote the stat block and playtested it. Mm-hmm. And went, yeah, this is really fun. I don't know what it looks like. And I just got the artwork in last week. And he did a great job. It's
nice.
It's a fun, unique monster that's a blend of something from real mythology and from other fun games. And so we've tried to have, so we have a number of unique monsters that you actually won't find in other games. Mm-hmm. But that are similar to some other things, so you can kind of scratch your itch for those sorts of encounters.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, we are kind of at the end of our time here, so I have one more question for you before we get your plugs in and then we take this one home. This is a mm-hmm. question everyone gets asked when they come on Rollin' Bones. The answer can be as philosophical or as sophomoric as you want it to be. So DM Blackwall, if you could put anything on a t-shirt, what would it be?
Interesting. If I could put anything on a t-shirt?
Yep.
I got a buddy I used to work with who, his name's Bruce. The man has a bunch of stickers of his face that are all over our city, on vehicles, in bars. I think I'd put that on a t-shirt. And give that away. I've even got one of his stickers in a cupboard in my apartment, so that whenever anyone who has never been here before opens the cupboard, they kind of freak out because there's this guy looking at them.
Nice.
Yeah, no, and he spent a lot of time trying to make that a thing. Like, he bought good vinyl stickers and stuff. It's pretty funny. Like, it's there are a surprising number of places you can find his face.
Man, so he's not even like just, you know, trying to like sell anything. He just wanted his face all over the city.
That's correct.
Oh, man. Well, I mean, this has been a great conversation. I would love to have you back on to talk about any number of topics, be it, you know, history or weaponry, or even, you know, talking about this game again. Because it sounds fascinating, and I would love at some point to get in on one of the playtests that you're running.
Yeah, that'd be great. I would be happy both to have you playtest and to visit again. And if you want to talk about like a specific area of history as well, I'm happy to do that. Just, you know, especially if it's something I've already studied, or if you warn me ahead so I can look into it a bit.
Yeah.
I mean, you will find some just ridiculous things from the past. Like, I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but there are probably, I was trying to do a count. There's probably over 100 different historical accounts of one guy fighting like 100 or 200 or 1,000 people and winning.
Mm-hmm.
It's not common. It's not like this happens every week, but like, almost every culture around the world who kept historical documents claimed it happened, and usually at choke points, bridges, castle entrances, these kinds of things. Like, even just stories like that, super cool, especially if you're into a heroic genre.
Yeah.
Because you can go, oh, no, this is a thing that actually does happen. It's mm-hmm. just uncommon.
Absolutely.
I really like that.
Yeah. All right. Well, guys, that's going to do it for tonight's Rollin' Bones. Again, this has been a great conversation, and I hate that we're having to end it here, because I feel like I could go on for another hour with you. But this is going to do it for this week's Rollin' Bones. Next week, Diversity in Dragons will be right here on Rollin' Bones. I'm not sure what specifically we'll be talking about. We'll see if there's any kind of shenanigans that transpire between now and then. But in general, I feel like there's going to be a lot to discuss with Diversity and Dragons. So, you know, join us next week. He'll be on here. And until then, guys, whether you rolled a 1 or a 20, I'm so glad that you rolled your bones with me, Ryan Howard, and I will see you guys next time.